You are listening to You, Me, and an Album, episode 42. I'm Al Melbourne.
The atmosphere, you know, there's more atmosphere in this track than you could find on like 10 albums by many other bands. And that really grabs me, really speaks to me. And yeah, again, it's kind of, some parts of my enjoyment of this album are very difficult to put my finger on and articulate precisely, but this track I always look forward to, and at the end of it, it feels like I have been on some epic journey for the last 45, 50 minutes or however long.
That was Anthony Johnston talking about Paradise Lost's 1995 album, Draconian Times. Anthony is a writer of horror novels, graphic novels, comics, and video games, including Resident Evil Village. Anthony's graphic novel, The Coldest City, was the basis for the film Atomic Blonde, and he's written a productivity guide, The Organized Writer. Anthony, thank you so much for taking the time to come on here and help this podcast take a turn into the world of metal. So welcome to You, Me, and an Album.
Into metal and doom and gloom and darkness. Yes, it's lovely to be here, Al.
So, yeah, and looking up this band, Paradise Lost, which I will admit is a band I've never heard of. So that's cool. I'm getting introduced to something completely new here. One of the things I did see is that they've been categorized as doom metal. So I feel like it's a dumb question, but what's the distinction between doom metal and other metal subgenres?
No, I mean, it's a fair question because there are many subgenres in metal. It is, you know, it's a bit like jazz. You know, every band practically belongs in its own subgenre. Doom metal is generally, and I'm speaking in very general terms, obviously, but it is generally sort of melodramatic, moody, atmospheric, generally, but not always, a bit slower, heavy metal with often very sort of gothic lyrical themes. Sometimes the music harks back to kind of, you know, the 1980s post-punk and goth bands. But mainly, yeah, kind of the thing that long songs is a common thing in doom bands as well. I mean, not on this album, actually, yeah. But if you look at Paradise Lost's earlier work, there were lots of quite long songs. And then you get other bands for like My Dying Bride or Typo Negative who had some very, very long songs, and lots of other bands as well that do. So that's one of the things that separates them. Slow, long, but mostly it's about the atmosphere and the sense, like I said, of drama and melodrama and atmosphere. Almost, you know, they're not film soundtracks, obviously, but they kind of feel as if they're, you know, they belong in that sort of milieu.
Okay, well, that makes absolute sense after having listened to this album a few times, so that I can see how it fits in that genre very well. So yeah, we'll get to obviously this album, this band, this subgenre, I guess, of metal, and maybe just metal generally, because I've talked about it so little over the course of this podcast so far. But I want to go back to where we met, Anthony, because this is the second podcast we've done together, but obviously the first time you've been on this one. But you and I co-guested on one of my favorite podcasts, and I'm guessing one of your favorites, Tabletop Genesis, and Mike Ward was one of the earliest guests on this show. So that was really, really fun. We talked about an album that's probably obscure to people outside of Genesis fandom, but Tony Banks, The Fugitive. And that was a really fun time. So I'm glad that you're wanting to continue on with a different conversation.
Yeah, well, I love music and I love talking about music. I have my own podcast called Thrash It Out, which is just about heavy metal. All we do, my co-host Brian Letendry and I, all we do every episode is talk about heavy metal. So, yeah, I just, you know, but obviously my tastes are wide enough that I listen to more than just metal, hence why I was on a Genesis show and able to talk about it, as you say, a rather obscure and, you know, poorly selling Tony Banks solo album. Because, yeah, I love talking about music that I like.
Well, I'm glad that you're doing that here. Really looking forward to this. And before we do get into more musical discussion, of course, you're very, very busy and involved with a lot of different types of work. So I'm curious about what you've been working on lately. Now, I did notice on your Substack that you said that there's a beta draft out of the Patreos Network, which is part of your Brigitte Sharp series. I have to admit, I was not familiar with the concept of a beta draft. So Where are you at in that process, and what other things do you have going on?
I actually just got the last feedback from my beta readers for that manuscript back today as we record. Most authors probably wouldn't call it a beta draft, but beta readers are in the context of novels and books and writing in general, are readers that you send a finished but not polished version of your manuscript out to. I mean, it differs from author to author. Some will be rougher than others, but it's generally a sort of a completed but rough draft of the manuscript, and they read it on that understanding and give you feedback about, you know, does this plot point make sense? Are these characters consistent? Is there anything that I didn't understand? That sort of thing. I find it really valuable, and my beta readers are a mixture of other authors and just friends whose opinions I trust and who I know can read the manuscript whilst keeping in their mind that this is not the finished product, you know, that there will be mistakes and errors, and it probably won't be the most beautiful prose I've ever written. But that's because it is a rough draft. So yes, that's the third Brigitte Sharp book, and I finished that draft on 1st of September. And so, as I say, it went out to my beta readers, and I've just now had the last feedback back from them. So that now goes through a process. I take all their feedback into account, and I will polish it and rewrite it, and then it goes to my agent and editor at the end of October, I think that's due. So that's what I'm going to be working on immediately, as it were, in the immediate future. I also write video games. You mentioned Resident Evil Village, and I'm working on another couple of games at the moment. Games is one of those industries that is NDA'd to the hilt. So like Resident Evil, for example. I worked on Resident Evil for almost 2 years, and literally until the day the game was released, I wasn't able to tell people that I was working on it. That's the sort of industry that games is. So I can't tell you what I'm working on, but I am working on more video games. We're also in post-production on a indie movie that I'm producing. A friend of mine, Ian Lowson, is directing, called Don't. He just shot that last week, and now we're into post-production for a while on that. And believe it or not, because I'd sent the novel out, the beta draft of the novel out, I actually had about 10 days spare, as it were, at the start of this month, where I actually didn't have anything to do, and I knew that I could do with a sort of with a break, and, you know, because I've been working non-stop for quite some time, so I wrote my next album.
Oh my goodness.
that to me is, that's downtime, that's relaxation. So I have a musical project called Silencion, which is dark gothic ambient electronic music, and I'll be putting a new album out from that project for Halloween this year, basically in about a month's time.
Oh, so we'll be out that soon.
Yeah. I work pretty fast when I'm doing the Silencion stuff. I do sort of polish and refine it, but I try not to second guess myself too much. I take a very Brian Eno approach in that, you know, I kind of get it down, polish what's there, and then go, right, that's it, don't overthink it. So yeah, that will be out next month, and it's all, you know, very spooky, lots of clanging bells and ghostly whispers and haunted drone sounds and that sort of thing.
Well, that's perfectly timed. And I chuckled a little bit when you said, you know, taking the Brian Eno approach, because the previous episode was on U2's Pop album, and a big part of the story behind that album was how they kind of mixed it to death. So
well, mixing to death is not the same as composing to death.
Yeah, true. So looking forward to that. Where can we find that when it comes out?
The best place to find all of my stuff is to visit my website, which is just my name, anthonyjohnston.com, and there's links to everything on there.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'd have to try and spell out Silencion for your listeners, and they'd have to write it down, and it's too complicated.
All right, yeah, that sounds like an easier path, so I'll definitely be putting that in the notes and give everybody a reminder at the end of the show as well. So that's really, really cool. So there's so many different aspects to your work that I could ask you to drill down into, but I'm particularly interested in how you got started with writing thrillers and horror, because that's about the last thing I could imagine myself doing. I just don't know that I'd have the imagination. Plus, those are just not, you know, genres that I consume. So, I'm really interested to get a window into how you got into that and what it is that you enjoy the most about writing in those genres?
Well, the answer to those things is kind of the same, which is that I love reading mysteries and thrillers. And I do enjoy horror as well, obviously, and I work in horror quite a bit. But I don't actually read as much horror as I tend to sort of watch or play. You know, I watch horror movies, play horror games, more than read horror novels. But when it comes to books, I love reading thrillers and mysteries. And I love writing. I always try to write stories that I would want to read as a listener. As a reader. And I mean, I always try to write music that I would like as a listener as well. But I always try to write books that I would want to read as a reader. And for me, yeah, that is mysteries and thrillers. And it's hard to pin down exactly why. There's something about mysteries in all media that have always attracted me. You know, I love watching mystery TV shows and movies and stuff as well. I think it's the guessing game and it's the anticipation and not knowing what's coming next has just always interested me and excited me. And that's why I enjoy writing them as well. I mean, obviously when I'm writing, I do know what's coming next, but I still get that thrill from knowing that I'm constructing something that has that quality that people will read going like, I have no idea what's going to happen when I turn the page. That's really interesting to me. Which has some bearing on my musical tastes as well, I think, because a lot of my musical and don't get me wrong, I love a good straight up rock and roll song or pop song and stuff. You know, I'm no snob, but I do love and I have a sort of fondness and a tendency towards music that surprises me, that does the unexpected. I mean, I mentioned Eno, and he's a hero of mine for exactly that reason, because he will do things that you just do not expect and that maybe have never been done before, and that really interests and excites me in all walks of life, in all media, in all types of storytelling and music and entertainment in general. So yeah, it's really, like I say, it's hard to kind of pin it down any more specifically than that. I love mysteries. Thrillers are a good mystery. Spy stuff is kind of the ultimate mystery because everybody is trying to keep everything secret from everybody else. And I just, like I say, I love doing it, and it turns out I'm pretty good at it, so I keep doing it.
That's fantastic. Well, and you were going right in the direction where I was going to steer, which was translating that to music. And I figured there was a connection there, because just that, with both of us being Genesis fans, I figured that must be part of the appeal of Genesis and maybe more broadly prog rock for you, because it is those surprising twists and turns. So would I be right to assume that?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, both with Genesis and Marillion. I was a huge the Fish era of Marillion, huge fan of that as well, for exactly that reason. I was listening to Reel to Reel, the Marillion live album, not so long ago. And I must admit, I don't listen to Marillion as much now as I used to, for, you know, whatever reason. Not because I've gone off it, I just kind of, it doesn't come up on my playlist. But I thought, oh, I'll go there to listen, because I haven't listened to it in ages. And I was thinking, who makes music like this anymore? And I know that makes me sound like an old man who's ready to shuffle off this mortal coil. You know, I sound like a fossil. But really, who is making music like this anymore? With that sense of drama and change and surprise and, yeah, the progressive kind of, hey, let's have 10 different movements within a 10-minute song. who's doing that? I know people are, but there are so few of them now, and none of them seem to be, you know, having this kind of success that bands like Genesis and Marillion did. And I do think that's a shame. I'm not actually a huge progressive metal fan. I do like some progressive metal. Mm-hmm. I tend to prefer my metal a bit more, a bit simpler. I got into metal through Black Sabbath. Which also explains the doomy tastes, obviously, you know, the Devil's Chord and all that sort of thing. I heard Black Sabbath's Paranoid when I was, I think, 8 years old or thereabouts on a compilation album, and it just changed my life. It set the course of my life, you know, forever. And then my father was a Motorhead fan as well. So Black Sabbath and Motorhead were metal to me growing up as a child. And then when I was older, I got into stuff like, you know, Metallica, Ministry, Entombed, Swedish death metal, that sort of thing. And then started really broadening, you know, my metal tastes. But they've always been, as I say, a little bit more sort of straight ahead and simple than my non metal tastes. But the thing that ties them together, and even ties my metal tastes to Genesis, I suppose you could say, is, as I mentioned before, that sense of drama and melodrama. And I don't just mean in the lyrics. I mean, it can be in the lyrics, but in the music, the sense, you know, again, like I said about this album, you could say that about a lot of Genesis stuff as well. No, it's not a film soundtrack, but it feels like it belongs there. It feels like you are experiencing a story, and they're not afraid of that melodrama. They're not afraid of playing quite deliberately with your emotions, and just that hint of pomposity in the music to go, no, we're taking this seriously, and we are going to take you on a musical journey. Forget the lyrics, just musically, we're going to tell a story. You don't get that in a lot of other genres, but in rock and metal, you do. And it's kind of, not that it's a given, but it's not looked down upon in the same way. And that really sort of ties them, all of my musical taste on the rock spectrum together. You know, as I say, big fan of bands just in general that have that sense of atmosphere and drama, and that sense of telling a musical story. And I do like plenty of bands that lyrically tell a story as well, but that's not so important to me. Whereas with Genesis, obviously, that's a huge part of the appeal of them, is that lyrically they've always been superb as well.
Yeah, but I think if the music isn't what it was, that I wouldn't be as drawn in by the stories themselves. And I mean, if you look at the story, you know, probably the two things that you know, stand out as stories that could be standalone stories, it's Supper's Ready and the entire Lamb album. And those are both pretty bizarre, non-linear stories. So
they are.
The music helps a lot.
Although I would add Home by the Sea to that as well.
Okay.
Because I think, because that's one of my favorite Genesis sort of suites, if you like. And part of the reason I like that is because lyrically, it's really evocative and it's a great story. I mean, it's not a huge story, but it is a story. But then because you've got Second Home by the Sea, you know, musically continuing that story and then coming back around to the reprise at the end, it's all kind of feels like feels of a piece, feels unified. And I would put that up there with their sort of, you know, their top ranked stories. Here's a metal connection for you. Did you know that Steve Harris, the bassist of Iron Maiden and their principal songwriter, once cited Supper's Ready as one of his all-time favorite songs?
I did not know that. That is cool.
I remember reading that and thinking, well, if Steve Harris likes Genesis, then I'm fine.
Yeah, nothing to worry about there. Well, it was kind of interesting to hear you talk about the metal bands that you really like and the ones that were kind of formative for you, because I was going to hold back on this because this is an episode where I really want to defer to you a lot, because I'm not very well versed in metal. This band in particular, like I said, I had never even heard of a short while ago. But in listening to this album, I was reminded of three bands. And one was Metallica, which you mentioned. Another was Judas Priest. And another was Marillion. And different spots, wow, I really heard the influence, or at least so I thought I heard the influence of those three bands on this album.
That you would say, I mean, Marillion, I wouldn't have said myself, but now that you have said it, I guess I can see that. Judas Priest really interests me because, to those of us who are versed in metal, Judas Priest are a speed metal band, or at least what they became in the 80s. You know, they play very, very fast, very heavy. They have three guitarists, and Rob Halford shrieks in this really high-pitched, you know, powerful at the top of his voice bellow. And that is not what I associate with Paradise Lost at all.
Like I said,
so I find that fascinating.
It was in spots, and that, you know, this is probably, it was probably for good reason that I wasn't necessarily planning on saying that.
No, it's great. It's great.
But you know, as I took notes on the various tracks, I mean, there is some variation in terms of the tempo on these. So it and I noted that it was the faster ones that reminded me a little bit more of Judas Priest. The slower ones is where I heard more Metallica. Although really the vocalist, I mean, there's an awful lot of similarity there.
I mean, we'll get into this later, but it's funny. He doesn't sound like Hetfield on most of their other albums.
Oh, wow. Because he really does here. All right. Well, yeah, we will certainly get into the particulars of the tracks and the performances. But I have a theory, And now I'm also wondering if maybe this theory I have is based on maybe something you wrote in an email or maybe said at some point. But I'm going to test this out and ask you why you chose this particular album, because I do have an idea about why. So I'm curious to see why this album from this band.
I chose this partly because you had told me that you weren't very into metal. And so I figured, you know, even people who are into metal often haven't heard this album or aren't aware of Paradise Lost. So I figured you definitely wouldn't, you know, it would be an album that I was on safe ground in terms of nobody else on the show would have talked about it before. So there's that. But also, this is a very accessible album. It is heavy, you know, it rocks out, it sure does. But it is probably Paradise Lost's most commercial... Well, it is their most commercially successful and probably their most sort of commercially accessible album. It sounds less extreme than most of their other albums in one way or another, while also still being representative. And that's important because Paradise Lost, after this album was kind of the culmination of their rise. This is their fifth studio album, I believe, or maybe fourth. No, I think fifth. And it was, yeah, like I said, the culmination of their evolution as a metal band. They started out as a very, very underground death metal band. They kind of became a bit more doomy, happened to invent gothic metal along the way, as you do with their second album. And then each album, the third and fourth albums, were progressively more sort of mainstream, but also refining their gothic sound and this atmosphere and melodrama that I talked about, until you got to this album, which also had an enormous budget. By this point, they were poised to become like one of the biggest bands in the UK. You know, they were on the cover of metal magazines. They were being hailed as the great white hope of British metal. And this album kind of, you know, succeeded on large part because it fulfilled that promise. As I say, it's very accessible, it's quite mainstream, but it is also still very heavy. You know, lovely packaging as well. It had a huge marketing budget behind it from Music for Nations. But because, possibly because of that, partly because of that, they kind of went, well, we've taken this as far as it can go. And so the next few albums are not at all like this. They are much lighter. A couple of albums time after this, they put out a record called Host, which most of their detractors refer to as their Depeche Mode album. And they're not entirely wrong. It's still really, really gloomy and quite heavy emotionally, but sonically it's very, very light. They never broke through in the sense that a lot of people thought they would, because they refused to repeat themselves. They went, like, we can't make another album like Draconian Times because we've done it already. I mean, Draconian Times itself is almost kind of like a highly polished version of their previous album, Icon, which is actually my favourite Paradise Lost album. Believe it or not, this is not my favourite album. I like it a lot, but my favourite album is the one before this, which is a bit more raw, if you like. I mean, if you want to make a Genesis comparison, this is their Shapes album compared to Abacab.
Okay, that's an analogy that makes sense to me.
Yeah, like, you know how on Abacab you can feel Genesis trying to figure out what kind of a band they are and almost getting there, but it's still a bit raw and unfinished. And then with the Shapes album, everything is really just locked into place and they know exactly what they're doing. That's kind of what those two albums are like for Paradise Lost. So as I say, getting back to the point of this album, it's representative of their sound. If you like this album, there's a very, very good chance that you will like many or at least several of their other albums. And that's why it's a good pick. But also, like I say, it is their most commercially successful album. It sold many, many, many copies and continues to sell and is easily available as a result. So if any of your listeners are intrigued by this, they can find this album. It's on all the streaming services. You can get CDs of it. You can probably even still get vinyl of it, you know. It's, like I say, it's out there. It's not an obscure album by the band.
Yeah, and yeah, for my listening, I streamed it off of Spotify, so very easy to find. But I win. Because that, and again, I have this kind of vague notion that you must have mentioned this somewhere along the way. I don't think I'm pulling this out of thin air, but I was thinking, Yeah, I remember talking with you when we recorded the Genesis podcast and you being so enthusiastic about metal and then, you know, putting on that first track from this album, which was not at all what I expected. And, you know, but really throughout it having a just a little bit of a pop feel. And I said, I have a feeling this is like the bridge album. This is the album that gets you into the pure, more metal kind of stuff.
And it absolutely did. Yeah. Like I said, it was really successful, but also lots and lots of modern metal bands, gothic metal bands and symphonic metal. There's another subgenre for you. Cite Paradise Lost and particularly the Icon Draconian Times period as a huge influence on them. You know, like I say, this album is quite old now, so it's, unless you are an aficionado, I wouldn't expect you to be aware of it, but it is hard to overstate how influential this album was on that generation of metal musicians. You know, if you were, I mean, not if they were obviously into sort of death metal, you know, and that kind of extremes, but, you know, people who were just getting into metal and trying to figure out what it could do that wasn't just straight ahead speed were listening to to this album and other bands in this genre. And like I say, this album was just huge at the time. Here's an indication, actually, I mentioned the marketing budget. Here's an indication of how much the label got behind this album. And this is a personal association that I have with it as well. I like I said, I was already a fan of this band. And I loved Icon. And I knew this album was coming out. And Kerrang, the British metal music paper, ran a competition to attend a launch party for this album, and I entered it and I got a place.
Oh wow.
And part of the reason I entered it is because, and I'm sure this isn't the case anymore with online stuff, but it used to be the case, certainly here in the UK, that almost nobody entered write-in competitions from magazines. This is just an industry thing that I found out by accident, that like almost nobody entered those competitions. So I used to enter them all the time if there was something that I wanted. And a lot of the time I won as a result. So I did win this. When I got down there and I spoke to we all had to go down to London for the launch party. And when I got there, I actually spoke to the Kerrang rep and he said only 19 people entered. There were 20 places and they only had 19 entries. So everybody who entered got a place. Anyway, they drove us to Chislehurst Caves outside of London, took us on a tour through the caves. They have, I think there's a connection there with Led Zeppelin or somebody like that. I can't remember off the top of my head now. And then at the end of the tour, they took us basically into one of the caverns that had a bar already installed in it and a table of food and what have you. And they said, right, now we're going to play you the entire album. And then after that, the band's going to come out and you can have a chat with them. Wow. And they did. So I stood there and first heard this album underground in a cave right the way through from start to finish. And they literally played the whole thing from start to finish with no break or anything. So everybody was just stood there in silence listening to this album for the first time. And then, yeah, the band came out and we all had a drink and had a very good time. And the band, by the way, are lovely, lovely people. It's a great amusing irony that a band that makes such sort of doomy, miserable gothic music are actually some of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. It was such a weird experience. But it was great as well. And also this album was the first with a new drummer. And I mention that because the drummer up until this album was okay, but he was still an amateur. They'd all started out as school children, but the rest of the band had become better musicians over the years, and the previous drummer just kind of hadn't, not at the same rate anyway, and he knew it. And so he left and they got in another drummer who was already a professional. And if you go and listen to Icon and compare it to this, just the drums alone, the difference is astounding. But as a result, when you hear that first track, and I don't want to jump ahead to the track by track, but you know from having heard it, when you listen to that first track, the drums are a huge feature of it. And standing there hearing them in this cave, for heaven's sake, with it echoing and booming off the walls, what an experience. It was great.
So, yeah, thanks to Wikipedia, I know that drummer is Lee Morris. And
that's right, yes.
Just throughout the album, I mean, the things that impressed me the most were his drumming and the lead guitar playing.
Right, and
phenomenal on every track.
The lead guitar is Greg McIntosh, who also writes all the music. Nick Holmes, the vocalist, writes all the lyrics. And then you have Steve Edmondson on bass and Aaron Adey, one of my favorite ever musicians, on rhythm guitar. And one of the reasons I love Aaron is because I've seen Paradise Lost live many, many times. Probably more than any other band, actually, come to think of it. And throughout it all, and even now, because they're basically the same age as me, so they're all, you know, approaching or around 50. Even now, he plants his feet on the side, like he's off on the side of the stage, he plants his feet and he's lost in it. He's just got this huge grin on his face, head banging away throughout the entire performance. He's great. It just, you've never seen a man look like he's having so much fun on stage without actually moving around anywhere. Like, he never moves. It's wonderful. So yeah, I love her. We'll get into it on the track by track. There's a thing on one of these tracks. And the previous drummer, by the way, was a guy called Matt Archer. He then went on to be a very, very successful TV producer. He went to work for MTV UK and then from there to others. And he's now a really, like, you know, senior successful TV producer of all things. Go figure. So it all worked out in the end.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, it worked out for him. Worked out for the rest of the band, too. So I think I'm ready for the track by track.
Sure.
I'm itching to go here, yeah.
Well, there's one other thing that I'll say that sets Paradise Lost apart from, or did set them apart from, a lot of their contemporaries at the time, not so much now. And you mentioned the lead playing. So the idea of having the lead guitar almost play a second melody throughout the entire song, at the time, was really unusual in metal. Like, normally you'd have two guitarists, but they'd be playing chords, you know, chugging away during a verse, and then you might get a bit of a flourish at the end of a line or in a pre-chorus or something, and of course you'd have guitar solos. But the idea of having a lead player who played, like I say, like a second melody that isn't necessarily even related to the lyrical melody, pretty much throughout the entire song while somebody else is playing the rhythm chords, that was really unusual. It's one of the things that helped create the genre and really, like I say, set them apart from the other bands in their sort of, you know, their contemporaries. Right to take. And I mention that now because you have to kind of not understand it going into the album, but it's something to bear in mind as you listen to all these tracks, that this is part of how they layered their sound and how they get that atmosphere across, is by using that lead guitar in ways that, like I say, at the time were quite innovative and unique.
Well, you know, there's really no way for me to get around this unless I do, you know, two separate shows, like a before and after. But I, you know, it's an insight I wish I had had while listening to the album, because there were a couple of spots where I noticed some interplay between the guitar lead and the vocals, and create a little bit dissonance, and it was interesting. And
yeah.
But I didn't really note it as like a key feature of their sound, much less something that was innovative or unusual when it was recorded. So that's a really cool thing to know.
Again, like I say, unless you were around at the time or you're an aficionado, I wouldn't expect you to know that at the time it was innovative, because now it's much more common. Again, like I say, it's, people don't realize how much of an influence the band had, even though, you know, a lot of people just have never heard of them. But yeah, so let's get into the track by track.
All right, yeah, and we'll start at the start. As I already mentioned, this first track, Enchantment, starts with piano, and this is not what I was expecting, knowing that this was going to be a metal album, and so I have to say, for me, it had a little bit of an element of, like, Spinal Tap. You know, with, you know, starting out very quiet and gentle in a way I didn't expect, but it, you know, it builds and layers, and I thought this was a really cool track and a great introduction. I mean, not only an album, like you were saying, that could be an entry point for other things in their catalog and in the genre, but just even a way to kind of ease me as a listener into the whole rest of the album.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's a classic opener. One of my favorite openers of theirs on any album. It's actually, I'm surprised in a way that it caught you off guard, but maybe that's just because you know you're not that familiar with metal. Ever since Ride the Lightning, which was Metallica's second album, because that was so successful and so influential, it's been kind of a cliche for metal albums to open a sort of acoustically, you know, with either acoustic guitar or piano or, you know, violins sometimes even, and then blast you with something heavy. Now, piano has become a cliche for gothic metal and symphonic metal because it's got that classical feel to it. This, I think, was one of the first albums that did that rather than acoustic guitar. But as you say, it lulls you into a false sense of security almost, because you've got this lovely, you know, you've got a synth pad underneath it and the lovely little melody, and it's kind of melancholy, but oh, okay, that's quite pleasant. And then bang, in come the drums and the guitars, and you're like, whoa. It's a statement of intent, and that's what makes it a great opener for me, because yeah, it really is, it's indicative of what you're gonna get, and it has, again, that drama. It's majestic, it's powerful, it's an overture, if you like, to the album. And I know that's a little bit pretentious to say about a heavy metal album, but it really is like an overture to the rest of the album. And the sound of it, I mean, this is also where you encounter the sound. Now, again, you didn't have the context of their previous albums, but this is... The producer of this album, Simon Effemy, had worked with them on their previous two albums. But, like I said, this album had the biggest budget that they'd had up until this point. And this is the cleanest distortion, if that makes sense. The cleanest sounding album that they had made up until that point. You know, you could just tell, if you were familiar with the band, that this was an expensive production, because the previous albums had just been a little bit grimier, a little bit grungier. You know, the sound wasn't quite so clean, whereas here, at times, it's almost too clean. It's, the guitar is so bright in some places that personally I would have, you know, turned the treble down a little bit. But yeah, so you get that here, and you, as I say, you really know what you're in for. And then the middle eight in this song, the power in that middle eight, you've got the guitar tone and Nick roaring. They opened the tour when they toured this album, the Draconian Times tour, they opened with this track every night. And when it got to that middle eight, the crowd went nuts. And so did I. I mean, I was there in the crowd. We all just went absolutely mad because it's such a great middle eight. It's real punching the air kind of stuff. And I mentioned sort of doom metal being slow but still heavy. There's a great example of that when you come out of that middle eight in this song, and in the outro as well. They're both really great examples of how you can play slow but still have that power and the heaviness. Think of, I mean, outside of metal, in more traditional rock, think of John Bonham. You know, John Bonham was not the most virtuosic or fastest drummer in the world, and didn't want to be, but my god, he was heavy, because he, just because of the way he played, and you know, he hit the drums harder than most other people. And that's what you get from this song. It's a huge, it's a slow headbanger, but it is, as I say, it has that majestic, epic feel. You know, you've even got some synth string stabs at the end.
I was going to ask you about those.
They are synths, yeah, those aren't real. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because there are no strings in the credits that I found, but it definitely sounded like strings. So yeah, I probably should have understood that those were synths, but you reminded me to ask you that when you were talking about how some metal songs will start off with strings and then, you know, go into the heavy guitars.
I mean, some bands do use real strings, and Paradise Lost have used real strings on other albums, but on this album, I believe that they're all synths, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on into the second track, Hallowed Land. And this is one I went back and re-listened to a couple of extra times above and beyond just the straight through listening of the album, because I really like this one a lot. It's my early favorite. And it's got this kind of what I termed as a galloping guitar riff. I don't know if that's really the best word, but it just really, I think it just really propels the song and really got me hooked into it.
Yeah, this is the catchy one. It was a staple of Paradise Lost albums for a while that the first track would be that powerful, majestic opener, and then the second track would be really catchy. And they kept that up for many, many albums. Not so much now. But yeah, for a while there, that was, you could guarantee that the second track, as you said, would be the one that on, you know how on first listen of an album, there's always one track that you go, oh, and listen to it again.
Yeah.
You know, like talking about Genesis, Land of Confusion on Invisible Touch. That was that track for me. You know, I got to that track and I was like, whoa, 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 rewind, play that again, you know. Well, that's what this track is on this album. Yeah, it is. It's just a really great, catchy track. You've got a great example of dynamics with the piano break in the pre-chorus. You know, again, kind of slightly pompous, but they're not afraid to just go, no, we're going to cut everything out and just have a bit of piano. Why not? And then, of course, the pre-chorus and the chorus themselves are as catchy as hell. Nick Holmes, up until this album, probably wasn't known for his vocal melodies. Like, not that he hadn't done them, but I think maybe they hadn't stood out. But on this album, I think he really excelled himself. And ever since, he's been, in my mind, one of the great vocal melody writers who really doesn't get the credit that I think he deserves for it. His scansion and his intonation and his word choice and the melody choice, and even things like the changes, like the last, in the second pre-chorus of this song, when the last line is spoken, when you expect it to be kind of screamed out, and it results in this anticipation that builds to the chorus, which then does explode. That's great. You know, it's a simple little thing, but it's so effective. And then the way this track ends, not with the chorus, as you'd expect it to, but with the pre-chorus reworked in a heavier version with new lyrics. And then it goes into a coda line that is entirely new, like that doesn't appear anywhere else in the song. That, I mean, that's the sort of thing you expect from somebody like Genesis or Tony Banks. You know, it could go horribly wrong, but they but they pull it off. And that is the sort of unexpected swerve that I love about the best of Paradise Lost music. It's like I said before, about doing the unexpected. You know, you really don't expect that from what is otherwise a good, catchy, but fairly straight ahead rock song. And then suddenly at the end, it all twists and changes. You're like, wait, what was that? I didn't expect that. And yet it works. And yeah, that to me that's the hallmark of a great song.
Yeah, and this was the one where I thought, okay, maybe there really is a pretty clear connection between Genesis and this band. I could hear a version of Genesis, like the Calling All Stations version of Genesis, where they got a little bit heavier. And, you know, that piano part that you were talking about before the pre-chorus, and, you know, I could almost hear that as a part of one of their heavier songs. But I love that section of this song because, yeah, you get that piano, which is a mood change, but then you get those, like, chunky guitar chords coming in and the second go-around. Yeah. It's yummy. Yeah, it's really good.
It really is. Do you know, I could really hear Ray Wilson singing this now that you've said that.
Well, it's funny because that got me really thinking about that album and thinking, and it's nothing against Ray Wilson because I like him as a vocalist and I really like that album. But it made me think that choosing him as the vocalist wasn't the boldest of moves. Like they could have gotten somebody that was maybe more metal, because some of those songs are verging on metal.
They're getting there, certainly. You know, yeah, you can hear Rutherford's influence on that album quite a bit, I think, in those songs. I don't know. I mean, you know, on the other hand, Ray Wilson sounds absolutely nothing like Phil Collins, so it was brave in that sense.
Yes.
But I know what you mean. They could have gone further. Yeah, you know, I like that album a lot more than most other Genesis fans, but alas, you know, was not to be.
Yeah, same here. And in fact, I made a pitch for it on the last episode, because we were talking about kind of misfit albums in certain bands' catalogs, and that one certainly fits for me. I like it a lot.
Misfit album is a great way of describing Calling All Stations. Yeah, I like that.
All right. So, well, not to hijack this and for me to try to turn this into another Genesis podcast, but so we'll move on to the third track, The Last Time, which I wrote. This feels like the single, and in fact, it was the first single on the album.
Yes, it
is. So I actually want to refer back to something that you said in just your breakdown of Hallowed Land, talking about the vocal melodies. And this was a track where I actually was very distracted by the vocal melodies, because it's definitely the poppiest song. And yet I feel like the melodies, at least in the delivery, were neither poppy nor menacing. they didn't really seem to fit. They felt a little awkward, particularly in the verses. So I'm just curious as to how you hear this song, because that was something that really kind of tainted it a little bit for me.
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't get that, but I think that's because, like I say, this was not my first exposure to the band, so I was familiar with, you know, Nick's voice and his way of singing. It's funny, because you're right, this was the first single, and I remember how well I remember the cries of sellout from people when they heard this track, because it is a straight ahead headbanger, and it is kind of a bit poppy and a bit mainstream, but it has those touches of Paradise Lost in it. Like, there's the slightly atonal chord changes, and Greg plays that single note drone lead over the chorus. If you listen to it, it's the same note throughout the entire chorus. The chords are changing underneath, but Nick is singing the same thing over and over, and Greg is playing the same note on the lead over and over. You know, Aaron is the one doing all the sort of melody chord work, as it were. It was an unusual track for them at the time. It remains an unusual track for them. They did do a few other tracks like this on following albums, and they all sound a bit odd as a result, because they're not quite what you expect from them. But I will say, they still play this live quite regularly, I believe. You know, it's a real crowd pleaser. But you're right that Nick's voice is, when he sings like this, it's not necessarily the best fit for this kind of straight ahead song. On the album after this, the lead single from that was kind of similar, in that it was a straight up, you know, straight ahead rock song, but he modified his style, and it was much less rasp in his voice.
Yeah.
And that actually suited it a lot better, even though the song wasn't quite as good, in my opinion. But yeah, on this one, I can see where you're coming from. Like I say, for me, this is one of those things where I'm so familiar with this album, so familiar with, you know, I know every nuance, every drum fill, every bent note, like every inch of this album, as it were. So it's really kind of difficult for me to be objective about it, to be honest. But I can see where you're coming from. Yeah, it's especially, as I say, if you're not familiar with the band, I can see how you might go, oh, there's a few bum notes in there.
Yeah. Yeah, he just didn't feel committed to it. Like you said in that single from the following album where he really adjusted his style, and you know that would have probably worked here. Or I think for him to just deliver the vocals in a style that was consistent with the rest of the album. But to me, it just felt like neither here nor there.
Yeah. No, I can see that.
Yeah. But yeah, it's catchy. Like I said, it was, you know, clearly a single. And yeah, definitely stands out on the album as such. And then the fourth track was also a single, Forever Failure.
I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, ironic. You're right that it's that third track is, it's kind of the obvious single. You listen to it and go, well, that's clearly got to be the first single. But isn't it interesting that then the only other single from this album is so unlike that song?
Yes. Not anything like any single that I'm aware of. Yeah, it's an odd choice. Not, I'm not saying a bad choice. I actually think it's maybe the most memorable song on the album because you got that spoken word. It's you know, particularly a menacing doom type of feel on this track. So I did find it very memorable. Yeah,
that's Charles Manson.
Yes,
the spoken word. Just in case you went away. Yeah,
I had to look it up.
Right.
But strangely enough, the first time I heard it, I know this is going to just sound really bizarre to you, but I'm like, is that George W. Bush? But then I'm sure it wasn't. And then subsequently realized that, well, you know, he hadn't even become the U.S. president until several years after this album came out.
I don't think he was even governor of Texas when this was released, was he?
He may have been, but probably early on. It may not have been. So, yeah, obviously the timing would have been wrong for that. The lyrical content was completely wrong for that. but I had no idea who it was until I looked it up.
I have a hard time imagining. I mean, for all of Manson's faults, he was very articulate. And I have a hard time imagining hearing George Bush say these things. This is one of their best-known songs. This was actually a really successful single. And has come to be regarded as a classic by PL fans. It's the way it bursts in with the guitars after you get the Charlie Manson spoken bit, and then just everything, the guitars, the drums, Nick's voice, it all just comes in at once, is almost like a feint. Like, it's effective because it really grabs your attention, but then the rest of the song is not massively heavy. It's mm-hmm. really melancholy and sad and contemplative, but it's so well written. Everyone is kind of firing on all cylinders on this track, for my money. You know, everybody gives a great performance. And it's a really epic song as well. And that's something that Paradise Lost really, they worked at and they succeeded at in quite fairly short order, because just a couple of albums before this, they were regularly writing songs that were 8-9 minutes long. And on this album, like, nothing is anywhere near that length. And yet, they still feel like you've been on a sort of epic journey. This song is only 4 minutes long, but it doesn't feel it. By the end of it, no. You don't feel shortchanged. You know, you feel like you've been on a journey. You've been up and down, high and low with them, like a real epic. And I think that's a massive testament to their evolution as songwriters, and their, because they do that several times on this album and on many of their other albums as well. They never really went back to the extremely long songs. They kept up, they have continued to keep up throughout their whole career, this ability to make epic sounding songs that are actually only 4 or 5 minutes long. It's remarkable. I think
it's actually something that I took note of, because most of the songs on the latter half of the album feel very quick. Like the first time listening through the album, I thought, wow, this album really moves along. Like, these are all really just, you know, quick, snappy songs, you know, particularly in the latter part of the album. But then it sort of accentuates the ones that feel longer. So even though all the songs are roughly the same amount of time, I mean, kind of varying what between a little
more or less,
maybe close to 6 minutes. But yeah, it feels like that gap is much, much bigger.
Yeah, well, and one of the ways, and they do it on this track, one of the ways in which they do that as well is with extended musical outros. Mm. Like, on this track, the last 2 minutes of a 4 minute track are entirely instrumental, like, apart from Manson's voice, apart from those recordings. But yeah, other than that, half of the track, the back half of the track, is entirely instrumental. creates this sense of a huge composition, you know, as if it's got parts and movements and stuff, and it doesn't. But because we're so used to hearing songs, and maybe not so much for people like, you know, me and you who are used to listening to prog rock and stuff, but mm-hmm. most people are so used to listening to songs where there are lyrics and vocals constantly throughout, and you never go more than 30 seconds without hearing from the vocalist. And this band, you quite often can go for many, many minutes without hearing from the vocalist. You know, knowing when not to sing is a really important part of songwriting, in my opinion. And again, I think it's something that Paradise Lost got right eventually after a while. You know, as I say, their songwriting evolved a lot. And so, yeah, those extended musical outros are part, I think, of what helps make tracks feel bigger and longer than they actually are without outstaying their welcome.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely the case for a lot of these tracks, which is probably why I had that reaction to thinking that the track should be longer than they were in certain cases. Let's move on to Once Solemn. And this one kind of takes an interesting turn because there's a very brief intro. And my reaction to hearing that intro was, this almost sounds like punk. But then it does go into, you know, something very heavy very quickly. So I always kind of like that and appreciate that when a song takes an early turn like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. This is, I mentioned Aaron Adey, the rhythm guitarist, before. This is the song when they perform this live, which they still do, you know, fairly regularly. Nick always says, warns you, basically, plenty of action stage right, because that's where Aaron stands. And this song it's a great example. If ever you can find a video of them online, of them playing live or something, he's just feet apart, head down, bum, 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 headbanging while he's playing, you know? Yeah, like I say, you've never seen a guitarist look like he's having so much fun. This is another straight-up rocker, isn't it? I mean, it's another... I was surprised that this wasn't another single, to be honest, because it is... You could easily imagine hearing this played on the radio, especially on rock radio. The string scrapes are notable here. That used to be a staple of theirs, you know, that... down the fretboard.
They're so good. I noticed there's a lot of them throughout the album, and I'm like, and I thought about that because that's a sound it's such a staple, especially in metal. And I just realized how much I take that for granted. And I imagine there's a real art and skill to that, because it always sounds so good on this album.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there is, believe me, as a you know, a sort of occasional very, very amateur guitarist myself, they are, to get them that good and that consistent is not as easy as it looks. But yeah, that used to be a staple. I mean, you're right, there are a lot on this album, and there are a lot on many of their other albums as well. I don't think they do it so much anymore because it's kind of cheating almost. But yeah, there's loads of them on this track as well. I think practically every other line has got a string scrape on it. But again, it's a really short, 3 minutes long, this track. It's really short, like, again, straight ahead rocker. It's a good example of keeping things simple. You know, it doesn't need to be any more complex than it is. And again, that's kind of the restraint and the taste, having that awareness and going, do you know what, actually, we don't need to make this any more complicated. You know, we can keep it simple and it's still effective. I mean, I mentioned earlier that I grew up listening to Motorhead, and one of the things I love about Lemmy's songwriting was exactly that simplicity. He was like, yeah, it doesn't need to be any more complicated than this. It's rock and roll, you know, just sort of keep it simple, keep it rocking straight down the line. And obviously they don't do that. Paradise Lost don't do that on most of their tracks, but occasionally they hit a track like this where it's just straight down the middle, no messing around, no real surprises, but just a good straight up headbanger.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. And it's kind of nice that that's something they can do and do well. And it changes up the pace a little on the album.
It really does. Yeah. Because then you get into something like the next track, Shadow Kings, which has that big build up. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go on, play it.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, so yeah, let's go there.
Yeah. It's got that big build up in the intro, you know, the climbing guitars and the drums, it all really sort of sets you up for something big. And yeah, the contrast between this and the previous track is huge.
This one was sneaky for me because I found myself probably around the second or third time listening to the album, like really jamming out to it and literally tapping my toes to it, which was not something I really thought I would be, you know, doing with a metal album. But so this is another one that I kind of went back and listened a little more carefully to see what was going on in it that I had that response to it. And one thing I wasn't sure about, because you're talking about the buildup and the end being very big. And I think part of that bigness is what I think is the kick drum. And I wrote, that's some serious kick drum stamina over the final 70 seconds. But it sounds more like a tom. So I don't know if it's a tom where then they did a separate track with the snare or if that is just kick drum with snare.
I think that is just kick drum. I mean, there might be some toms in there as well, but generally when you on this album especially, Morris's toms are quite a pitched relatively high, actually, especially for a metal album. So I think that is just kick, yeah. This is, again, if you're not familiar with metal, the endurance of metal drummers is really impressive. You know, it's one of the things that bugs a lot of metal fans when people disparage the genre, as especially when other musicians disparage it. It's like, oh, well, those guys can't really play. Like, if you watch a metal drummer play a gig, they are sweating buckets by the end of it. You know, the physical strength needed to play heavy metal drums particularly is enormous. So yeah, I think that is just kick, and it's, you're right, it's impressive, but it's also kind of standard for most metal drummers would look at that and go, yeah, easy. Because it's just, yeah, you know, for a metal drummer, for a jazz drummer, that might be quite a feat. But for a metal drummer, that's just Sunday morning.
Well, for this beginning drummer, it's pretty much unimaginable to keep those eighth notes going at that pace for that long.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, yeah, go and listen to some Slipknot sometime and, yeah, be horrified. Did you listen to the chords underneath the chorus in this?
No, I didn't really make note of that, no.
So I should say Shadow Kings is a fine song. It's not my favorite song on the album, but it's fine. But one of the things I do really like about it is that the chord changes underneath this chorus are, again, for the time, maybe not so much now, but in 1995, these are not chord changes that you expect. You know, they're doing unusual things and leaping around in sort of, you know, sharp and flat chords all over the fretboard. Really quite unusual for the time, and became a hallmark of doom and gothic metal. And you've also got you get it in the middle eight as well. Again, the chord changes. Nobody else was doing those kind of chord changes at the time, apart from the other doom bands. One of my other favourite metal bands is a band called My Dying Bride, who are actually from the same part of England as Paradise Lost. They're like 20 miles apart or something. And I now live in that part of the country, incidentally. And that's not deliberate. I'm not stalking them or anything, but I just happen to wind up living in the same part of England as two of my favourite bands. Go figure. Yeah, the doom bands were doing that sort of thing, but nobody else really was. And it really kind of set a template for the genre. Again, those sharp and flat chord changes, very unusual. Just not at all what you sort of, if you're listening with a practiced melodic ear, it's not at all what you expect. And I like that because it kind of catches you off guard. And then you've got the key change. The key change at the end. That is, you don't get key changes in metal. I mean, it's not, maybe in Def Leppard or something, you know, but in serious hard metal like this, you don't expect key changes. But it works. It kind of, because it only does it for the instrumental part, it does it again for that instrumental outro with, as you said, the sort of extended drumming, it kind of elevates it. And you've got Greg repeating that lead line over and over and over again. It's so... Even now, I'm like, a key change? Really? But it works. It works. Go figure.
You know, there's a lot going on. It feels like there's a lot of different sections of the song. And I'll admit that I was just so fascinated by that kick drum and tried to figure out, parse it out. Is that really a kick drum or is that Tom? That I didn't dig into the key changes and what was, you know, what was going on in some other parts of the song. So I know there's probably more than on any other track, I think there's a lot for me to unpack with some subsequent listens here.
It's one of the most complex songs on the album, actually, thinking about it. Yeah, yeah. So there is, as you said, there is a lot to unpack, but it's worth it. Like I say, not my favorite track in the album, but yeah, definitely a good one.
All right, well, we are getting now into, yeah, I think, yeah, the second half of the album. And
I think that actually would have been the end of side one on the vinyl.
Yeah, yeah. I'm yeah. glad you think that way, because a lot of times, even with very recent albums, I think, oh, well, this is where you flip the album. So, yeah. although track 7 out of 12 does not at all feel like a side opener, Elusive Cure. And this, for me, was probably one of the least memorable tracks. I could not hum the melody for you at all. And I just noted that this was one of the few songs where I could really notice the bass without trying.
Right.
Which I'm sure, you know, again, with more listening, I probably find some really cool bass playing, because the bass that I did hear was really cool. But yeah, this was one where I didn't have to really hunt for it.
A lot of the bass, Steve Edmondson is very much a kind of, how can I put it? He's like a journeyman bassist. You know, he's developed over the years into a very, very good, accomplished and talented bass player, but he doesn't show off. And most of the time he is just playing root notes. You know, most of the time he's doing that standard rock bassist thing of just playing the root notes, and there's an occasional little flourish here and there. There are tracks that are exceptions. This is one of them. There's another one later on where, you know, where you'll hear more from him. But he has always been a very solid, like, you know, I do not want the spotlight on me. I'm just going to stand here by the drums and support the rest of the band, lay down the foundation for the rest of the band, as it were. So, yeah, there aren't that many tracks where you can kind of pick out the bass, because it is just playing those root notes, you know, and so it's all just there in the mix. I love this song. I'm a little sad that it wasn't that memorable for you. Because you've got that acoustic intro in, again, into a big blast of guitars. But you've also got the melancholy, plaintive lead playing going through almost the whole song. It's like a wailing cry running through the main parts of the song. And, I mean, it's probably not easy to hear, again, if you're not used to it. But for me, that's great. I love that part, because that, to me, is that dissonance and that sort of, like I said, almost like a sort of plaintive howl, is very gothic. And I also think that these are some of Nick's best lyrics on the album. Again, I think, you know, he's underrated as a lyricist as he is as a melody writer. But the lyrics on this song, you know, I can no longer bear it. The way he sings that just gets me every time. Yeah, this is, I wouldn't say it's, again, not my favourite song on the album, but it's definitely up there. It's definitely in the top half. So, yeah, I'm a little sad.
Have we hit your favourite song yet?
No.
Okay, all right. Mystery.
No. I mean, the Enchantment and Hallowed Land are definitely up there. Like the first two, the opener, you know, the big epic opener, and then the catchy Hallowed Land. But then so is Forever Failure. You know, we mentioned that. Like I said, that was a huge success as a single. You know, those are all great songs. This one, like I say, I do like. I mean, it's got that. This is another one that's, it's only 3:20 long, and I always, when I'm listening to it, I find that amazing. Not even 3.5 minutes long, and yet this song feels, to me, feels so big. you know, so kind of spacious, that, yeah, it's one that I always look forward to, more so than Shadow Kings. Because I say Shadow Kings, it's okay, but it's not, it's definitely in the bottom half of the album for me. So I always look for, I won't skip it, but I always, when Shadow Kings is ending, I'm always like, oh, Elusive Cure's next. Oh, I get excited.
Yeah, those are great, you know, great moments of album listening there. And, you know, I should do a better job of couching, because on a lot of these episodes, I talk about tracks being more memorable, less memorable. And that's really the way I should be couching that, is it's really a way for me to say, I can contribute a little more to this conversation, but not to this one. So
sure.
I, you know, hearing you talk about this track and what you really like about it and what makes it a track that you look forward to, that's a fun thing for me when I go in the editing process and go over those clips that you're alluding to, and like, oh, okay, I see exactly what he's talking about. And I haven't listened to this album enough times to zero in on that yet. So,
and yeah, and I mean, to be clear, I don't expect that at all. Like I say, I know this album like the back of my hand, so I have you at a distinct disadvantage, as it were.
Yeah, but it, I, you know, I mean, I definitely should make that clear to people I'm talking to on this podcast, but also, you know, for the listeners too, because I don't mean for it to come across as any sort of judgment on the album, because what I think I understood even before doing this podcast, and which I have a much greater appreciation for now, here after all these episodes, is, I mean, how a lot of albums, a lot of really good albums, it really takes a long time to appreciate everything that's there. So,
oh, it does, absolutely, yeah.
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 All right, well, let's move on to track number 8, Yearn for Change. I liked this one, and I heard major Rush influence all the way around.
Oh, really?
On this
How
one,
interesting.
Especially the drumming. So many Neil Peart fills in this one. But even the guitar melody to me sounded a little bit like Alex Lifeson. It just, you know, I could hear the song. I could hear Geddy Lee singing the song. It would obviously sound very different with a Geddy Lee vocal. But yeah, this to me was Rush.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Yeah, it's one of my favorites on the album. This is absolutely in the top half for me. That fantastic lead-in solo. That's one of the few solos I can play. I can actually play that one.
Awesome.
I spent weeks learning that intro solo because I like it so much. And it, this is another one that's, it is kind of a straight ahead rocker, but it has some musical complexity to it as well. It's got those layers underneath the verse, and then the chorus with that incredibly high guitar. Like the lead is almost too high, you know, almost painful in the chorus. Nick is screaming at the top of his lungs. It's so like, just, you know, pin your ears back. But it works. I really like it. The middle 8 here as well, I think, is fantastic. Really, really, again, simple but effective. And that line, "Life is all the pain we endeavor." What a line. What a great lyric. You know, if you want your gothic heavy metal, there you go. It's right there for you. And then the end of this one, this has a fantastic ending, this song, with that the downward lead part and the crashing drum fills. Like, you know you're heading for the end. There's no mistaking, oh, here we go, this is the climax, you know, get ready. And it doesn't disappoint. It's, yeah, one of the best tracks on the album for me.
Yeah, those fills, I mean, certainly because they remind me of Neil Peart, but... just on their own, they really make that ending very sort of heroic.
Maybe I should listen to more Rush. I'm not the biggest Rush fan in the world. Maybe I should give them another try.
I have mixed feelings about Neil Peart as a drummer, to be honest. I mean, I obviously admire the, you know, the incredible skill. I'm probably just gonna get just roasted for saying this, but it was a little too robotic for my tastes.
Oh, wow. A drummer who's too accurate. Yeah, that will get you. Fans aren't going to like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I as a listener, that is how I feel about some of it. But I should probably move on here before I really get myself in trouble. All right, well, Shades of God. I wrote, for me, this is not one of the better songs. Again, you know, with the asterisks, very, very early on, very few listenings. But I love the way that this is produced, with particularly the way that the drums are panned in several parts.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really grabbed my attention. Just one of those, you know, almost like a little kind of Easter egg to kind of look forward to, like, oh, here it goes from the right to the left.
Yeah, it is. It slows things down a bit after a couple of, you know, we've had a couple of solid rockers up until this point, and then this is a change of pace, which is good. And there's some good lead work here from Greg, but I actually agree with you. I don't think this is one of the better tracks on the album. It doesn't, to me, this doesn't quite live up to the quality of the rest of the album. You know, it's kind of, if this had been a B-side, I don't think it would have been missed. To be honest, It's also weird because their album, two albums prior to this, was called Shades of God, and yet this is the album that has a track called Shades of God. It didn't have a track called Shades of God. That was just the name of the album. So confusing. But yeah, it's. I mean, I won't skip it. I don't skip anything on this album. But I agree that it's not one of the strongest. It's not, like I say, for me, at the same level of quality as the rest of the tracks on this album. I think this is also the only place in the album where they use a choir sound. You were talking about the production, and It is almost overproduced in some ways, this track. It's very odd that of all the tracks, this is the one that has a choir, and then they don't use it anywhere else, when you can think of several tracks on this album where it probably would have fitted. Very odd.
Yeah, I mean, it was really different enough that it almost felt like I probably should have just gone and see, like, oh, was there a different producer for this one? Because it sounded different from the other tracks.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a story behind that. It's not. It's one producer for the whole album. So,
yeah.
But I don't know if maybe this was the first or last track, you know, that they recorded, because sometimes that can, you know, feel quite different to the rest of the album. Yeah, I don't know. It is a weird one.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting little tidbit about the title. Remind me of Face Dances by The Who. And then, you know, Pete Townsend on a separate album had Face Dances. So,
yeah.
something's written for an album, but then it isn't used. And
right. But that's the thing. I'm not sure if this track was written for that old album, because it doesn't sound anything like the previous albums either. So I don't think it was a track left over from that album, you know, a title track left over, because surely if they'd done that, they would have just changed the title. So I don't know. Very odd.
Yeah, strange.
If ever I run into them a gig again, I'll have to ask them.
I was gonna say, yeah, you had your one shot there, but maybe you'll get another one.
I know what'd happen if I'd ask him about, you know, what happened there and why. They'd just look at me and go, it's 25 years ago, don't remember a bloody thing.
Yeah, so I
guarantee.
Guess I don't need to have that conversation, since you know how it's gonna play out anyway.
Yeah.
So the next track, I am guessing you made a reference earlier when I was talking about being able to hear the bass in Elusive Cure. I'm guessing Hands of Reason, the next track, was the other one you were referencing.
Yes,
where you could. Okay, because I didn't really have much to comment here again, other than the bass being easier to follow on this one.
Yeah, the bass is absolutely mixed higher on this track. I mean, I do love a good drum and bass only intro. You know, there have been some great rock songs written like that start out with just the drum and the bass to really kind of get you moving and get you rolling. And it has a lovely guitar line as well. But yeah, it is, the bass is very much kind of in your face on this one, and works. I mean, I think it works for the track. The punchiness of the pre-chorus on this one, I think, is really good. It's very, again, slow but powerful. Lots of impact. I don't have a lot to say about this either. I do like this track a lot, but there's not actually much to say about it. It's not complex. You know, it's not unusual. It's just it's just a really good song. Like I say, I do like it a lot. It's also, this is one is a fantastic song to sing along with in the car, you know, if you're driving along at 70 on the freeway, at the top of your lungs. Absolutely great one to belt out at the top of your voice. You're told of treasures, indulgence cannot wait, but wait for tomorrow, and steal some sanity. But yeah, I don't have a lot to say about it. It's just a good song.
Well, that makes me feel better when I come up empty on some of these. And yeah, it's not anything against the song oftentimes. It's just, yeah, just nothing stands out because, yeah, maybe it's just a good song and I just need to note it as such. Well, we're down to the last two then. I See Your Face. And I just wrote a little joke to myself here. Must be the follow-up to I Just Want to See His Face because I did Exile on Main Street a couple episodes ago. The other thing that I wrote here is that I could easily get this mixed up with Yearn for Change. So I'm wondering if you hear the similarities there. Because I was listening to it. It's like, haven't I heard this track already? And I went back and forth between this one. And they both start with clean guitar. The melody seems similar to me. And so I don't think I was just, I don't know. There seemed to be something to it because I actually went back and compared them. And they did sound very similar to me.
I mean, now that you've said that, I guess I can see it a little, yeah. I mean, the intro is different, but it does, yeah, it is clean and it builds. But one of the things I like about this track, this is effectively the closing track, really, mm-hmm. because the final track, we'll get to that later, but this is effectively the closing track. This is kind of the capper on that statement of intent that I mentioned at the beginning. And what I love about this track is that you can tell that it sounds like a closer, and that's really ineffable. It's really difficult for me to kind of articulate why that is, but there is something about the rhythm, the pace, and the melody even of this song that it just feels like this is the last track of the night. You know, everybody jump up and down and, you know, here we go. This is the final push towards the end. When you seal my face, sorrow turns to hate. If I could see your light shining, this is borrowed time, maybe a final
time. That I could see your light shining. Well, yeah, I did not note that, but I think maybe subconsciously I was tapping into that because the comment that I wrote for the final track on the album, Jaded, was this is a sprawling down-tempo type of closer. So I was already making that distinction in my head between, you know, the kind of, you know, boisterous up-tempo type of closer, which, you know, clearly I See Your Face would be that if it were the actual last track. So that's kind of interesting that I noticed it but didn't notice it.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like the album's a palindrome. To an extent, because it starts off with a slow, powerful, epic track, and then you get the faster, catchy track. And this is a fast, catchy track that you can rock out to, and then it ends with a slow, big, majestic epic. So, yeah, it's almost like the two ends of the album are mirror images of each other.
Yeah, no, that's... I didn't make that connection either, but that definitely fits, and you know, as such, I thought it was an appropriate closer, even though, you know, I can't hear that penultimate track as a kind of a secondary closer as well.
Yeah, well, like I say, it feels to me like it's kind of, yeah, almost like that's the final track, and then Jaded is the epilogue, almost.
Yeah.
And I want to say, you asked me a long time ago, and we weren't there yet, Jaded, track 12, is my favorite track on this album.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, what is it about the track?
They, for a while, again, sort of, they don't do it so much now, but they went through a period on their albums where the final track was always something slow, sad, mournful, melancholy, but big, sounded big and atmospheric, and like being lowered into a grave. And I know that sounds flippant, but it really, if you go and listen to like the closing tracks on all of their albums from around this period, they're all kind of like, you know, funeral dirge almost sort of stuff. I think this is the slowest track on the album, which certainly fits with that. Nick's lyrics are fantastic. The vocal melody and the arrangement is great as well. But musically, it is dripping with atmosphere. Greg's solo at the end is wonderful and melodic, but also, again, you know, sort of sad and atonal. It's a good encapsulation, actually, of his style and his solos around this time. The atmosphere, you know, there's more atmosphere in this track than you could find on like 10 albums by many other bands, and that really grabs me, really speaks to me. And yeah, again, it's kind of, it's some parts of my enjoyment of this album are very difficult to put my finger on and articulate precisely, but this track I always look forward to, and at the end of it, it feels like I have been on some epic journey for the last 45, 50 minutes or however long. And that wouldn't work for me without this track. You know, you could finish the album with I See Your Face, but it would feel a very, very different album if you did. The final track is so important to how you, to your overall impression of an album and how it leaves you. And leaving this album in this way with this track, I think, is what, you know, really elevates it to make it a classic.
You're right. It is so important because it really, it makes the difference in some way between whether or not you'll go to the trouble of maybe going through some tracks that you perceive as weaker towards the end of the album. And that, you know, that's often what happens, is whether it purposely happens here, or not. Yeah. That bands put the tracks, I mean, or the converse of it, which I've talked about on some previous episodes, is that there's that, you know, batting order metaphor that you put the heavy hitters up front. So you don't have the heavy hitters on the back end, and albums can lag a little bit. So if you've got that, just that kick-ass closer to look forward to, that it puts, you know, those second, third, fourth, the last tracks in a bit of a different context. And I'm actually thinking, and I actually feel like this is kind of a good way to kind of start to wrap up this discussion. One of the other bands that was introduced to me through this podcast that I had never, ever heard before, the guest came on to talk about them, was the New Pornographers. And that is an album I still have on heavy rotation. I love that album, and I'm so grateful that David Greenman came on here and introduced me to Electric Version. But that's an album too. Not that I would say there are, you know, tracks that I dislike. I think the album's consistently great. But if there were any inclination to, you know, see it kind of lag towards the end, the final track is one of the best tracks on the album, and it is definitely something I look forward to. And so it's kind of the same with this one. This is a band I'd never heard of before. I enjoyed this album so much more than I ever could have imagined that I would have.
Oh, and I'm really glad to hear that.
and I'm glad to be able to say it. And I, you know, I think there's a lot more here, as I said before, a lot more for me to explore, a lot more to unpack. But part of what I really like and appreciate already at this early stage is the pacing and the sequencing, that, you know, there's enough changes in tempo and mood that it holds my interest for the most part. I do feel like the latter half of the album for me dragged a little bit more, but, you know, there were enough things to look forward to there that, it, you know, next time I listen to the album, I don't see that I would necessarily skip any tracks. I'd just go straight through.
Sure. And like I say, I agree with you that there are some weaker tracks towards the end of this album. But yeah, knowing that I See Your Face and Jaded are kind of waiting for me there at the end, you know, always gets me through. And I would say, if you given that you're, I mean, I'm very glad that you enjoyed this more than you thought you would, but knowing that obviously that you're not a metal guy, if you want to explore further, I would suggest From Here Moving Forwards, through their discography. So the next album was called 1 Second. The album after that is Host. That's the sort of electronica album I mentioned. And then after that, there was an album called Believe in Nothing. And they are their sort of, those three albums are their lightest albums, as it were, you know, for want of a better description. But they are also, because, you know, they only get better in terms of their songwriting. You know, they keep getting better and better and better with every album. And their style and their sound changes, but the quality just keeps increasing. And you mentioned, you know, sort of pacing. The next album, 1 Second, is so superbly paced. And I actually think some of its best tracks are on the back half of the album. Some of my favorite tracks on that album are, you know, tracks like 7, 8, 9 or whatever. Not that I don't also love tracks 1, 2, and 3, but, you know, it doesn't, it's one of the rare albums that for me doesn't dip at any point. It just maintains this really, really high level throughout. And then, as I say, the album after that, Host, is so unlike anything that you'll have heard from the band previously. That's a whole, you talked about misfit albums, you know, that's their misfit album, if you like. So yeah, definitely for you and for any other listeners out there who might be intrigued but, you know, aren't really sort of heavy fans, definitely move forward, you know, go on to the next 2 or 3 albums after this, and you may find something there you like even more, because, as I say, the quality of their songwriting only improved.
Yeah, well, when I asked you the question about why you chose this album, and I suspected it was because it was one that I would find more accessible, I almost wonder what it would be like to have dove right into something that was heavier. But, you know, either way, you know, it doesn't really matter how you get there.
I mean, if you want to do that, go backwards. Go to Icon, the album before this. Because, like I said, that's kind of, it feels, I mean, that is my favorite Paradise Lost album. But it is much, much heavier than this one in the traditional heavy metal sense. It is less poppy. It still has melody, don't get me wrong, but it's less poppy. It's less mainstream. There are one or two tracks on it which are just out and out, like heavy chord fest dirges, which I love. But again, you know, if you're not into that, you're not going to love it. But there are also some great singles on there as well. So if you want to try something heavier from them, yeah, go back and try the album before this. Or they also did... I think it was their 2010, I think, album. Hang on a second. Let me just click through on Wikipedia and find... 2009, sorry, my mistake. 2009 album, Faith Divides Us, Death Unites Us. There's a nice cheery album title for you.
Oh, yeah.
That is my favourite album of theirs in their sort of modern era. What they did around the sort of mid-2000s was they started going back to heaviness. And to the point where now they are almost a sort of death metal band again, in some respects. But that album in 2009, for me, was the real sweet spot between the melody, poppiness, and the heaviness. Of their sort of latter era, that's my favourite album. So maybe try that one as well. Also, that had a session drummer whose name escapes me, but who is, my goodness, just so talented. None of their regular drummers have even come close to his level of playing and... I don't want to say skill, because I have seen their regular drummers play those songs, but I gather, when they recorded that particular album, that session drummer wrote a lot of his own parts, rather than taking, you know, too much direction from the band. And it really shows. It's if you're interested in the drums particularly, that's a great album for you.
I'm gonna want to check that out, just because to the fact that I'd be listening to a drummer that's impressing you more than Lee Morris, and I mean his playing was such a highlight for me on this album. I want to see what that comparison is. Something to look forward to.
Yeah, and I do love Lee Morris's drums. You know, he was with PL for I think 5 albums or so. And I mean no disrespect to any drummer before or since, but for me, he was their best drummer, because he was a bit more sort of, you know, poppily inclined. And I think when you combine that with the much more metal music side of things, I think it created a great dynamic you know, because you had, as you said, some really great drum fills and lovely little touches and paradiddles and all that sort of stuff, you know, lovely little cymbal hits and things in there, which a lot of metal drummers just don't do or don't think of. And I, for me, the combination of those with Greg's very, very heavy, you know, gothic playing and musical songwriting was a great combination. And I, yeah, like I say, it's for me, it's a shame that he's not still with the band, because I thought he was the best drummer that they've had. And they have had several. They've been remarkably stable, actually, in terms of lineup. That, like, the only position that's changed over the years is the drummer's position. But you mentioned Spinal Tap right at the
you
opening.
Were going to go there, I was.
They have been through quite a few drummers over the years, it must be said. It's such a, you know, it's a bit of a shame. They have now a young Finnish drummer, Valtteri, who is some wunderkind, who can just play basically anything, it would seem. You know, he's one of these new generation who can just play absolutely anything that you throw at him. And he's great, and he's been with them a while, and hopefully will be with them for many years to come. But yes, they the sticks position has changed many times over the years in PL, but none of the other positions.
Okay, well, you know, I mean, that's not uncommon, which is, you know, why Spinal Tap was able to make that joke and we could all laugh at it. But, I just really thank you, Anthony, for coming on here and, you know, introducing me to a really cool album, a band I didn't know that now I'm very, very happy to know. So I do, as I promised earlier, I do want to remind people where they can find you. So yeah, your site, AnthonyJohnston.com, where they can also sign up for your newsletter, correct?
Yes, and there's a link on my website to sign up for that. But actually, that's an even easier URL, because that's ajwriter.substack.com.
All right, well, perfect. And then I know you are on Twitter at Anthony Johnston. Is there any place else on social media that people can and should give you a follow?
I mean, I am also on Instagram and Facebook. Because my name is unusually spelled, I am able to grab social media accounts quite easily. So basically, as long as you spell my name correctly, and that's AnthonyJohnston, as long as you spell it correctly, you will find me on the internet and on social media, because it's almost unique, that spelling.
Well, I must have misspelled it before. I'm actually getting onto Instagram right now. There are quite a few Anthony Johnstons on Instagram.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I managed to grab... I was clearly first then.
You win. Yeah, I should have just clicked on that first one, because yes, this is you. Anthony Johnston on Instagram. So, definitely give him a follow there as well. And I hope you maybe give me a follow as well. I'm on Twitter at AlMelchiorBB, and that's just my general account where there's really more baseball than anything else, but some music stuff. But if you just want me to stick to music, you can follow me on Twitter at UMeAlbum, and also on Instagram at UMeAlbum. And just to remind everybody that if you do want to know who the upcoming guests are, what albums they're going to be bringing on here, that is the place to find out. I usually let you know 3, 4, sometimes 5 days ahead of time, so you can listen ahead. And I do that on both UMeAlbum accounts, Twitter and Instagram. So Anthony Johnston, thank you for taking time out of your very, very busy schedule. Looking forward to your album release, your book, and everything you've got coming. And again, thank you for joining me here.
It was my pleasure, Al. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So that's going to be it for this episode, but I will be back again next week, next Sunday, with a new album, new guest, new episode. So until then, everybody, hope you listen to some great music, and take care.